Nothing stops when we're gone. The seasons don't stop. This river doesn't stop. The lives of the people we love won't stop. Time keeps on spooling. Stories keep getting written.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with novelist Jeff Zentner. His young adult novel, The Serpent King, published by Crown Books, is filled with big-hearted characters, misfits, and miscreants, cornered by the crushing weight of destiny.
The ossifying conviction that they are living out some ancient and preordained plan, encoded in blood, built into the architecture of name.
Here comes The Serpent King and its author, Jeff Zentner, on Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
You got the serpent's tongue. You fill my mind with your pretty lies.
Today we'll be talking with Nashville author Jeff Zentner. His young adult novel, The Serpent King, is about
young people who struggle to lead lives of dignity and find beauty in a forgotten, unglamorous place.
You got the serpent's tongue.
And who wonder
what becomes of dreams once they cross the county line.
Jeff Zentner, novelist, lawyer, singer-songwriter, who works with young musicians at Tennessee Teen Rock Camp. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell us about Dilwayne Early. He's a musician. His father's gotten in some trouble.
So Dil is definitely the main protagonist of the book, and he's based on a lot of things. He's very close to my own heart, of course, in terms of his being a musician. I also grew up in a household where a fairly strict religious faith was a big part of my upbringing. Now, my parents are nothing whatsoever like Dil's parents. They were great, supportive parents, and they gave me all kinds of opportunities. But I could definitely see how religion works within a family, and I could see how it could work to be an influence for making somebody feel imprisoned and making somebody feel as though they couldn't do the things that they wanted to do.
And in this book, it's the Pentecostal church, and it's the sect that uses and works with snakes.
That's right. It's a Pentecostal snake-handling sect. There's no religious sect I can point to and say that's the one, because this sect was an invention of Dil's father, who shares his name, Dillard Early Sr., but it's based on the same theological principles as existing snake-handling churches, where they've taken a verse from the Bible, Mark 16:18, that says more or less that if you are faithful, you can pick up deadly serpents and not be harmed. You can drink poisonous things and not be harmed. And the adherents of these faiths interpret this scripture quite literally, to where they handle poisonous snakes as part of their religious service, as a show of faith. Dil certainly feels imprisoned by his circumstances. His father is involved in a very heinous crime, very much unbecoming a man of the cloth. And it results in Dil's family becoming pariahs in the community. And part of his father's trial involves Dil having to testify against his father, because his father attempts to shift the blame over to Dil.
But the congregation cannot accept the fact that this leader of the church has done this.
That's right, because there was some question whether Dil had done it or whether his father had done it. And it comes up in the book that Dil has never passed the test of faith of picking up the serpents, whereas the father has week after week. So from the outside, as these congregants looking at this situation, they're looking at it saying, well, we know Pastor Early has passed the test of faith. We haven't seen Dil Jr. pass the test of faith. So between the two, who do we believe? We believe the pastor.
There are three characters here, Dil, Lydia, and Travis.
There were things Dillard Wayne Early Jr. dreaded more than the start of school at Forestville High. Not many, but a few. Thinking about the future was one of them. Dil didn't enjoy doing that. He didn't much care for talking about religion with his mother. That never left him feeling happy or saved.
Mothers don't betray all the love that your babies gave. It is not okay to up and fade away.
So why didn't Dil like thinking about the future?
because he didn't have much of a future. Between his family's debt, between his mother's pressures on him to drop out of school and to work and to help her pay down their debts, between the bleakness of his life where his family doesn't have a computer, they don't have a TV, they lead this very monastic existence, he just does not have much of a future. And one thing he does have is Lydia.
Water wash away all the love that this world has gave. It is not okay to up and fade away.
The black frames of her glasses creaked across her cheekbone. Her two tousled smoky blue hair, the color of a faded November sky streaked with clouds, smelled like honey, fig, and vetiver.
I was born and raised in Forestville, Tennessee, population 4,237, according to the latest census. Not surprisingly, technology startups, software companies, media conglomerates, and so forth are reluctant to set up shop in a town named for Nathan Bedford Forrest, Confederate general and founder of the Ku Klux Klan. Opportunity and possibility don't knock at your door in Forestville. You have to create them for yourself.
Shake the devil off your shoulder, come on down and raise your head. Who's gonna pick it up if you didn't staring at the wishing well? Look down like a sinking penny, with the time is slipping through your hands. Salvation, it ain't coming, get off your knees and stay.
Tell us about Lydia.
Lydia was inspired by my fascination with, generally, teenagers who use the internet to be part of national conversations, because the internet affords that opportunity now. You can be a teenager, and from your bedroom, you can be part of the national conversation. In spite of the fact that she's achieved some pretty impressive things, she's been interviewed in the New York Times, she's been invited to New York Fashion Week, she's got important friends in the movie business, in the fashion business, but at the same time, she doesn't quite fit in. Part of it is because she's got a bit of a prickly personality. She doesn't take any nonsense from anybody. She knows who she is. She knows what she wants. And she's going to go get it. And she's not going to let anything stand in her way.
Go on traveling down that road. Find what you're looking for so you can let it go. You can walk a thousand miles.
But I also wanted to explore the ways that she uses her privilege and her station to help her friends and to push them to be more and to want more.
And Travis.
Travis came loping outside, ambling perhaps, whatever bears do. All 6 feet, 6 inches, and 250 pounds of him. His shaggy, curly red hair and patchy red teenager beard were wet from the shower. He wore his signature black work boots, black Wranglers, and baggy black dress shirt buttoned all the way up. Around his neck, he wore a necklace with a chintzy pewter dragon gripping a purple crystal ball, a memento from some Renaissance festival. He always wore it. He carried a dog-eared paperback from the Bloodfall series, something else he was seldom without.
Reynard Northbrook's day's labors were almost at an end. As Lord of Northholme, he did not need to soil his hands with work. He did it because he loved the sweet, spicy smell of cut wood and the rich, earthy smell of damp soil. A man's work kept the back and arm strong for war, and he would need every ounce of strength in the coming days.
Tell us a little bit about Travis. Very quiet, strong, silent. Ironically, he loves fantasy novels.
He came out of a fascination with these guys I see in Tennessee, and I'm sure you have them here in Arkansas, where they embody an interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, they're very country in a lot of ways, the way they talk, their physical presence, the professions they've chosen to pursue. Travis works at a lumber yard. On the other hand, they're fascinated with these fantasy realms and these fantasy worlds that you don't usually think of as within the purview of people who work blue-collar jobs. And in fact, there's a great tradition in America of people from rural areas, rural America, loving fantasy.
Which of these characters were you most like growing up?
This is going to sound like a cop-out, but I was really like all three. I truly took my personality and my being, and I divided them into thirds, and I gave each one of the three characters a big part of me to hold. Dill has my struggles with faith and my view of the world's beauty. Lydia very much has my sense of humor and my curiosity and ambition. And Travis has my nerdiness, the way I sink myself completely into the things that I love and that interest me. So they are all part of me. None of them are completely me.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with novelist Jeff Zentner about his young adult novel, The Serpent King.
Hold on. Don't let go. Take my arm.
Okay, boys, the last time we ever go shopping together. Thank the sweet Lord.
They take this trip to Nashville for clothes shopping, but it's really a metaphor.
It is. It's a trip that really shows in microcosm the dynamic of their friendship. It shows Lydia influencing Dill by dressing him. She takes Dill's very, very limited clothing budget, which would maybe buy a pair of jeans at American Eagle. And she takes him to a vintage store in Nashville. She uses her marketing clout to bargain down the store owner and gets Dill a wonderful new stylish wardrobe for school. And that's emblematic of the way that she uses what she has and her resources to help Dill. Meanwhile, Travis is in the back of Lydia's Toyota Prius for the whole trip, reading his dog-eared paperback, wearing his same black Wranglers, his same black cheap dress shirt buttoned all the way up to the top that he always wears.
Let's go running through open fields in the summer rain.
And at one point, the store owner asked Travis, hey, you know, I don't know that we've got much that fits a guy your size, but if you want to look around, you certainly can. And Travis says, no, I'm fine. I wear the same thing every day because it's one less thing to think about.
Let's go running to a better place. A better place.
It had thoroughly scandalized Forestville, Tennessee, when Pastor Early of the Church of Christ's Disciples with Signs of Belief went to the state penitentiary, and not for the reasons anyone expected. Everyone assumed he'd get in trouble someday for the 27 or so rattlesnakes and copperheads his congregants passed around each Sunday. No one knew with certainty what law they were breaking, but it seemed unlawful somehow.
School is starting next week. It's their senior year. They go to this vintage clothing shop, but they also take a trip to Riverbed Prison in Nashville. Dill doesn't really want to go. His mother guilts him into it.
Free trip to Nashville. You should visit your father.
You better go visit your father or else, you mean? Dill set his jaw and looked at her. I don't want to. I hate it there.
It's not meant to be fun. That's why it's prison. Think he enjoys it?
Probably more than I enjoy it. Dill shrugged and gazed back out the window. Doubt it.
I don't ask for much, Dillard. It would make me happy. And it would make him happy.
Dill sighed and said nothing. You ask for plenty without actually asking for it.
You owe him. You're the only one.
I gotta go.
Dillard!
But he was out the door before she had the chance.
Dillard!
He felt burdened as he stepped into the bright summer morning, shielding his eyes to the sun. He glanced at the white Calvary Baptist Church up the street from his house. He squinted to read the sign out of habit. No Jesus, no peace. No Jesus, no peace, spelled K-N-O-W. What if you know Jesus, but have no peace? Does that mean that the sign is wrong, or does that mean you don't know Jesus quite as well as you think?
Why doesn't Dill want to visit his father?
Dill feels guilty for putting his father there, because really it was Dill's testimony that put his father there. He is afraid when he looks at his father that he's looking at his own future, that he's set on some unchangeable course, that he's set on tracks that have been laid for him before he was even born, that he's looking at his own destiny every time he looks at his father, and he hates to face that. He hates to face the past that his father represents. He hates to face the future that his father represents. Riverbend Prison was in a deceptively beautiful, pastoral part of Nashville. Rolling hills and a lush carpet of trees surrounded blocky beige buildings with slit windows. I won't be long.
No worries, dude. I can work on my back-to-school blog post.
Yeah, hurry up, Dill. I really want to get home and hang out with my cool dad instead of reading my favorite book.
Well, here I sit in the Bogan County Jail. Yeah, here I am just a sitting low in your Bogan County Jail. I'm wringing my hands from sorrow and far too weak to wail.
Dill's father was tall, gaunt, and raw-boned. Every time Dill saw him, he appeared harder, more cunning, more feral and serpentine.
Hello, Junior.
Dill hated being called Junior. They sat down. Dill's father set his hands on the table. He had Mark tattooed across one set of knuckles and 1618 tattooed across the other. Hi, Dad. You got some tattoos, looks like.
Yes, I did. They won't let me practice my science ministry in here, so I wear my faith on my skin.
Lord, that's why I'm sitting here in your Bogan County Jail.
They can't take that from me.
I got no use for your heaven, and I've already seen your hell.
Dill's father he's kind of scary.
He's a manipulator. He's a spiritual abuser. There's a part in the book where I say that he's got the kind of eyes that can convince somebody to make them hurt themselves. So how are you doing?
I'm living one day at a time. Praise Jesus.
Are you getting enough to eat?
My needs are met. How are you and your mother?
Surviving. Working hard.
I'm glad to hear that. Work hard. Pay off our debts so I can rebuild my ministry when the time is done. If you've grown mighty in faith by then.
You got no use for your heaven. And I've seen the flames of hell.
Dill shifted again in his seat and looked away. He didn't like making eye contact with his father. His father had the kind of eyes that made people do things they knew could hurt them.
Remember how you would write psalms and sing them with praise, Ben? Remember that?
Yeah, I guess. He's 13 and standing in front of his father's church with the rest of the praise band.
You're burning in my heart.
He's wearing his too large electric guitar, playing as loud and fast as he can while the drums and bass jar the flimsy walls and low particle board ceiling of the tiny church.
A secret on my tongue.
He makes mistakes left and right, but nobody notices because they're caught up in the Holy Spirit and the walls vibrate with the exalted and chaotic glossolalia of tongue-speaking. His father starts in his direction, carrying a copperhead draped around his neck. He stands in front of Dill and lifts the copperhead off himself. Dill's heart thrums in his ears. He stops playing. He's always been afraid of snakes. He meets his father's eyes. His father gives him a slight, sad smile and turns away, holding the snake above his head, triumphant. Dill is relieved, but disappointed that his lack of faith shines through his skin.
This is the moment when Dill cannot touch or pick up the snake himself. He can't handle it, so it seems to be the manifestation of his lack of faith.
This is really the scene where Dill realizes that his faith may not be the faith of his father. In the book, we see that his father is arrested a week after this happens, and Dill never has another opportunity because once his father's gone, their congregation collapses. And so Dill is left with this failure of faith and to make sense of it and to try to make his way through the world and have a relationship with his God in a way that allows for that kind of failure of faith.
Goodbye, Junior. Give your mother my love and tell her I'll write soon.
Dill's father raised his two fists and put them together side by side. Mark 16:18. Then he turned and walked away.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with novelist Jeff Zentner about his young adult novel, The Serpent King.
When will you come back home?
Would you set up the birthday scene?
This birthday scene is really intended to show the best it gets for Dill at home with his mother.
The fire's burning in the heart. The table's set.
And how the best it gets is not real great. Dill lit the candles the moment he heard his mom pull up.
Dillard, you home?
In here, Mom. She walked into the kitchen where Dill stood behind the cake, candlelight illuminating his face.
From the cold.
Happy birthday.
Dillard Wayne Early, what have you done?
I made you this cake. Sort of. I got the stuff and Travis's mom made it. It turned out a lot better than if I'd done it, I promise.
I don't even...
She sat down and blew out the candles. Did you make a wish?
I sure did. I wished for...
No, you can't tell me. Then the wish won't come true.
Wishes don't matter. Prayer does.
What if there were a way for me to make us a lot more money?
I'm not following what you mean there.
I'm talking about what if I were to maybe go to college? People who...
No!
But Mom, listen to me. You didn't let me finish.
No need. I know what you're going to say and what my answer will be.
Dill racked his brain for some Bible analogy that would encompass the idea of short-term loss in favor of long-term gain. Mom, I'm...
This is the last I want to hear of this. I've not said as much as you've gone running around with Lydia and Travis all the time. But now, I want you to honor me.
Guilt seized Dill. He felt that he was again failing a test of faith, like he was afraid to pick up yet another serpent.
She didn't want Dill to go to college. She was afraid that he would become more worldly and turn his back on his faith and the church, but secondly, she would be alone.
And I think not even she quite knows which is the primary reason. I think they occupy maybe equal spaces in her mind. I think she tells herself it's to prevent him from being more worldly, so she doesn't feel too selfish. There's never going to be a good time for him to talk about college with his mom, because the answer is always going to be no.
Holding on to the wheel, just me and my thoughts in this automobile. Hear that engine squeal, leaving Bartlesville.
So how much of this book is about understanding that one takes the spaces and places they inhabit along with them?
A lot of it. Dill finds beauty in the broken parts of his life. He loves to watch trains because that's available to him. There are train tracks that run through the town, and he can go and he can watch trains, and he finds meaning in it. They sat on a picnic table near enough to the train tracks that when they heard a train coming, they could get close. Lydia checked her phone.
A Waylon Jennings refrain. Texting your phone and I'm waiting on a train. Like a hurricane, I'm coming home.
Watching trains. Dill's version of YouTube. You know this is a very weird thing to do, yes?
Said the girl wearing clothing from five different decades, Dill said.
Touche.
Should we ask the guy wearing a dragon necklace if he thinks it's weird, Dill asked.
I don't think it's weird. Trains and big machines are cool.
Counting the telephone poles with outlaw country on the radio. Like a tornado, I'm coming home.
Why are you so into this?
Dill pondered. Trying to think of the least weird way to put it.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so when I watch trains, it makes me think about how much movement there is in the world. How every train has dozens of cars and every car has hundreds of parts. And all those parts and cars work day after day. And then there are all these other motions. People are born and die, seasons change, rivers flow to the sea. Earth circles the sun and the moon circles Earth. Everything whirring and spinning towards something. And I get to be part of it for a little while. The way I get to watch a train for a minute or two, and then it's gone. Then he thought, the way I get to be a part of your life before you're gone, and I'm left here, watching trains pass me by too. His cheeks flushed and he looked at the ground, preparing himself for whatever clever thing Lydia had to say. Anyway, sorry, weird. He glanced over at her. She stared at the tracks.
No,
Lydia said, all teasing gone from her voice.
Not weird.
Almost on cue, a train whistle sounded in the distance. As the train approached, they got up off the picnic table and stood near the tracks, close enough to feel the wind from the train. Dill experienced the familiar, rapturous rush of excitement and adrenaline as it neared, and began laying on the whistle. That rise as the clamor and energy of it built, threatening to overwhelm his senses until it was right upon him. He closed his eyes and listened to its various parts. Wheels squealing on the rails, the chug-chug-chug of one of the cars. He absorbed its violence and brawn as it slithered past, a massive steel serpent. That pounding, pulsing din stirred something inside him. For a fleeting moment, he's standing once more at the front of the praise band. He's wearing his guitar and they're playing, and the congregation begins to pass around the deadly serpents. His father approaches him with a copperhead. He stops playing. His father smiles and gently hands it to him. He reaches out and accepts his father's offering. It is cool and dry and sleek. It pulses in his hands. His faith is strong. It binds the serpent's jaws. It cannot hurt him. He stares into its face.
In this moment, he relives the same scene, and this time he's able to touch the serpent, take it up, and it shows he has faith. In himself, I imagine?
That's right. This is the scene where he realizes that what is extraordinary in him is something different than what is extraordinary in his father.
Your dedication for this book. This book is my love letter to those young people and anyone who has ever felt like them, no matter how or where they grew up.
I'm living on the moon, I guess. Don't understand a word you said. I tied the key to the old cat's leg, and I left you my old address.
What are you trying to tell young folks?
That this is a book about three young kids growing up in rural Tennessee, but really it's a book for anyone who's ever felt outcast, anyone who's ever felt like a misfit. But that last little bit is my note saying, if you find truth in this book, it's because you were meant to. It's not exclusive. It's a book about this, but it can be about your experience as well.
I know damn well what I am, a dim light on ever distant land, living on the moon again.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, Jeff Centner.
When will you come back home?
Silas Height. Ryan Saunders and Keith West.
Water wash away all the love that this world has gave.
Gallows Bound.
Shake the devil off your shoulder, come on down and raise your head.
Recognize. Jim Mize.
Let's go running to a better place.
Fret and worry.
Well, here I sit in the Bogan County Jail.
Adam Fawcett.
I'm living on the moon, I guess.
And the Crumbs.
Coming home to you.
Thank you to actors Sarah Huber, Hayes McNeely, Jennifer Atkins-Gordeva, and Holland Kalklager. Thanks to the excellent production work and the superb sound engineering of Mr. Chris Hickey, who helps us produce these shows. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to novelist Jeff Zentner, whose compassionate look at adolescence reminds us of the importance of literature, which allows us to step inside one's skin and walk around in it for a little while. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Harry Cruz. It takes great courage to look where you have to look, which is in yourself, in your experience, in your relationship with fellow beings.